Thanks, Eckhart.
Yeah, so in the spirit of this workshop, rather than going to any one subject in great detail, I'm actually going to talk about four loosely connected subjects in cursory detail. That all four of them have not been submitted for publication yet, although they're all very close. But in that vein, if your feedback would be appreciated, it'd be nice to get perspectives and what people find interesting, confusing, and so on about this work. It involves a variety of people. As Eckhart mentioned, I was at Woods Hole GFD Summer School, and I was fortunate there to supervise three of the fellows. And I'll talk about one of the fellows' work. This is Kate Snow, who's presently a PhD at ANU University in Canberra. So she did some experiments of turbidity currents going down slopes, and the thing we've added to that is putting in ambient stratification. Also, Kai Barrett, who's an undergrad, she's worked both on the problem of settling clay in fresh and salt water, and she also worked jointly on a project of internal solitary waves crashing on a shore and lifting up sediments. That was work that I also did with Greg Ivey when I was on sabbatical in University of Western Australia. And finally, I'm going to talk about just a very simple problem of taking a turbulent jet of fresh water, blasting through fresh water onto a bed of sand, and asking how does that crater form and what are its characteristics. So just simple problems, but trying to get some insight into how turbulence interacts with waves. So let's talk about the first of these four topics, clay sedimentation. So this is a satellite picture showing the Mississippi River emptying into the Gulf of Mexico. And of course, Mississippi is a very muddy river filled with silts and clays and so on. But once it enters the ocean, quickly, you don't see it sort of spread out. You see there's sort of these fronts, and then it just kind of disappears, the idea that it's being subducted under the surface. This is another observation showing here salinity in Chesapeake Bay. So for scale, that's about 20 kilometers, Washington, D.C., somewhere around there. And so this is showing salinity going from red being fresh to this being salty ocean water. So of course, because of tidal flows through here, you get some mixing between the fresh and salt. Also parallel to that is this picture of suspended inorganic sediment, so basically think clay, that's coming in from muddy rivers, comes in here, and it's not nearly as broadly distributed as this is. The clay sort of comes in, and then really it just washes out, it sediments out.
So is the depth average data measured across the entire water column?
It's from a small number of points, yes. So a lot of extrapolation is taking place, but it is depth averaged. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I'm focusing specifically on the problem of clay, which is a little nastier, say, than sand. And that's because clay, in a microscopic level, are really all these tiny little plates. And that means that they interact with each other, or in another sense, they might not interact with each other because of electric forces on the plates that might cause them to repel. Depends on what circumstance you're dealing with. If you just treated a plate like a sphere and took its typical size, which is on the order of, say, micrometers, and then worked out what's the Stokes settling velocity, you get this kind of settling velocity in water. And that means it would take on the order of about a day just to fall 10 centimeters. And yet, if you see the Mississippi River, all this stuff's really plunging down quite a bit.
Is that including things like rally in motion?
No, this is just to give an idea of how these are so small, they settle slowly, just assuming it's a sphere and nothing else. And what I'm going to show you, of course, is they don't settle as slowly as that, depending. So this is how you could go about studying it. This is my colleague Murray Gingras. You know, he's in Powlak. Does he get a glass of wine? No, he does this. And then he forces his students to do that. I do not do observational work, thank goodness. So I'm going to try to get to the grips with this problem by some laboratory experiments. So this is the setup of the experiment. It's really a tiny tank about the size of this part of the laptop. You can look at here, there's a sponge there for scale. So it's a tank that we light from behind. We have a black cloth just to get rid of any ambient light issues. We fill it up with water. In some experiments, we might add some salt to the water to make it slightly saline. And we'll also add some concentration of clay. and we'll stir it as vigorously as we can to make sure that the clay is individual particles floating around. We're not dealing with huge concentrations here. The concentrations are typically less than about 3%. Okay? So let me just show you what happens in this experiment. This is, again, about 10 centimeters tall is the region you're looking at. This is a time lapse, so this is 7 minutes, 8 minutes have gone by since we've started this experiment, just stirring like crazy, and then just watching the clay settle in fresh water. And you can see even after 20 minutes, not much has happened. I'm just going to show you what happens if you do the identical experiment, but now we've added a little bit of salt. Again, it's time-lapse, but you can see it's a dramatically different evolution.
That's the salt. Secrete the repulsion probe.
Exactly, and so that's what I'm going to explain in the next slide. This is an effect that geologists, I think, have been aware of for a long time, but it's just something that's never been measured in controlled experiments, so that's really the point. This is what's happening as a result of adding salt. Before you add salt, if you look at one of these plates of clay and another plate of clay, there's a natural charge distribution that sets up on these plates where it's typically positive in the middle and negative around the edges. And if you take these plates and you try to put them together, the repulsion between the negatives wins over the attraction between the negative and the positive. So these plates do not want to stick together, and so they really are just falling, you know, except for the fact that they're not spherical, but they're falling more or less at a Stokes settling velocity. However, if you add some salt, so now you've got some sodium and chlorine items, these ions act to shield this repulsive effect. For example, this chlorine might sit in between these two positives, and that allows these plates to get a bit closer together so that this negative can then attract to that positive. And as a result, the clays, the individual clay particles begin to flocculate. This is the sort of thing you might see from electron micrograph showing the flocculation between clay particles. So instead of settling as individual particles, they're flocculating, and then effectively you have a larger net particle, and that thing can fall faster. And that's why you see this sort of flocculation front. It goes down, and in fact that front, as it goes down, sweeps up more particles and makes them even bigger so that the front can continue to descend as a well-defined discrete step. Okay, so just some measurements of experiments. This in false color, which may be a bit confusing, are just time series from four different experiments. So this is time running on this axis, and the scale does change on each of the four depending on what experiment you're doing. And as always, the height of the tank from bottom to surface on this plot. And the colors are basically showing light intensity, how much light is getting through the tank. So initially, there's so much clay in the tank that almost very little light is getting through, so it looks bluish. And as, for example, in this experiment, where you have a bit of salt, you have a bit of clay concentration, the front settles and you can see it's really bright where you have no clay. And so this is our way that we can follow and track this descending front and work out how fast does the clay settle as a function of clay concentration and also as a function of salinity. So this is just measurement methods, but this is effectively the result. Here on this axis is the salinity of the solution, and this is the speed of descent of that front. And the error bars are more or less given by choosing some thresholds on either side of a midpoint. Okay? The different types of symbols drawn show you the different concentration of clay. So circles here are fairly weak concentrations of clay, 14 parts per thousand, going up to 40 parts per thousand with these triangles down here. And so one thing you see that is if you add enough salt, the salinity itself no longer really affects the sedimentation rate. Really what sets the sedimentation rate is the concentration of particles. Because the more particles you have, then you're able to form either bigger or smaller flocks, but then you might also have hindered settling as a result. And so we kind of merged all that data together. And so here's the speed now as a function of clay concentration. Since it didn't depend on salinity, we just averaged the results together. And you see, you get this kind of behavior that if you have weak clay concentrations, you have fairly fast settling speeds. And if you increase the clay concentration up to, say, 40 parts per thousand, you have hindered settling, so you have less fast settling. So and for whatever reason, it forms a minus 1.7 power law.
So what volume fractions does that correspond to?
across the board?
It's certainly less, it's maybe less than 5%. Okay. But you have to remember that when these flocks form, they're really at a tight front. And so it's not like they're uniformly distributed around. The flocks form at the front, and that front is coming down and sweeping and colliding.
Very high concentration, much higher concentration.
Yeah, so locally, I think you have higher concentration.
But also the flocks are not dense, maybe. They could be not fractal, maybe, but, you know, porous, at least. Yeah. They could even be fractal, in fact. But,
yeah.
I mean, they are not all this densely packed, I assume.
It's, now, and so this is the thing, when we could go up there by eye and stare at it, and I never saw by eye what looked like macroscopic flocks. But I know other people have done similar experiments, and you can actually see these flocks almost like that. You can see in an electron microscope picture, where you can actually see that they're very porous, as you say. But for us, we couldn't identify an individual flock. We could just see that there was a front and it looked more or less uniform.
So the effective volume fraction could be much higher.
Yeah, and the mass concentration.
Yeah, but that's still the idea, yeah.
So why do flocks predominantly form only at the front? Why don't they form throughout the entire region?
I think they are forming throughout the entire region, but because that settling front right at the top is descending, then it's sort of sweeping up the other flocks. You might have a couple of small flocks here, and maybe up here you've developed some bigger flocks. They come down, and because they're bigger, they sweep up the small flocks and make themselves even bigger. And so that's why right at that top front, as it's going down, it's always descending faster than, say, the little flocks that are developing here.
So it's not a priori obvious why there's even a well-defined speed. Because if the flocks are getting bigger as they sweep up stuff as they descend, shouldn't the speed continue increasing?
And so these are all the things that I don't fully understand. In fact, if anything, the speed, I guess is the best picture, the speed that we're measuring is here, and you can see, if anything, it's constant speed, but then slows down as it compactifies. But we don't really see much of an acceleration phase. So this is the part I understand. There must be some kind of balance going on, despite the argument I just gave that they're always growing in size. Mm-hmm. I think what happens is maybe they get to a certain size, and then this is very hand wavy. But now, if they get to a certain size, but they're going so fast, the shears of the fluid moving past them break them apart back to a smaller size.
Yeah.
So they hit a sort of equilibrium flock size.
They're not solid, so the drag on them could behave in ways that we don't think.
Right, so I can't just invoke a sort of Stokes settling type resistance.
The mat is sort of the additional drag is being balanced exactly by the additional mass when you have a constant velocity in that case.
Right, that's the idea. But again, it's just that the contradiction come up when I gave arguments, like I just did to Eckhart, about, well, they're coming down and they're sweeping up other flocks, so you think they're growing. So they have even more mass, but then they have more drag, so perhaps that works out into a balance. But it's not obvious a priori that should happen.
Interestingly enough, yes, you may know this, but the data that you just showed on the previous slide, the last line,
maybe the limiting case, the smaller hills go along and slower than
his whole career looking at flocks. He would say that everywhere in the ocean, it sort of boils down to between 0.2 and 0.3 millimeters a second. That's what flocks anywhere. If you need a number of the world's ocean in any environment, it's basically your low concentration value that you've recovered what we see in the oceans.
Great. I'd like to talk to you about that.
Another question to improve my understanding of what's going on. Yeah, if you could do the same under zero gravity, would you still see a separation? I mean, is it a phase separation under gravity, or is it a gravity-driven separation? But to me, it looks more like a phase separation under gravity.
But my understanding of this, and it doesn't come from what we saw in experiments, but reading the literature on this, is that gravity does play an important role.
It is
the idea that it is because once the flocks develop, they become negatively buoyant, they want to fall, and hence they interact more with other flocks. whereas otherwise they're just, you know, maybe they flocculate, but you just sit there, but you wouldn't see a front, for example, because you need gravity to have a descending front.
Yeah, but in the phase separation, you would also get heterogeneous nucleation, you would also probably get such a front. I mean, in phase separation, you're also looking for a meniscus to form on the gravity, and gravity mm-hmm. is then only kind of a helps to this, but to, you know, put the two phases apart mm-hmm. and make it really visible, but it's not really the ultimate driving force, which is then more microscopic.
Okay. Could be on, but my understanding is that gravity plays the fundamental role. That I think if you just did this in outer space, you know, you'd just, I imagine
stay
it's
homogeneous.
It, stay homogeneous. Yeah, yeah. That but you just, you know, I guess we've got to put it on the rocket, hey?
Maybe we can ask the company that launches
there
the
we
rocket.
Go.
Let's take a step on
board. Okay. So let me go on to a different subject now. This is the problem, of course, that many people here are familiar with, is turbidity currents. There's a lot on this picture from Eckhart and Ben's excellent review paper. But I'm particularly just focusing on the problem, ignoring canyons and everything else, just how does fluid, how does particle-laden fluid go down a slope with the new thing being asking the question, what happens if you actually consider the stratification of the ocean? What's the influence of, say, having a thermocline on that problem? So again, you could look at the Mississippi, but this may not be a great example because most of the rivers in the world, even if they seem to be laden with mud, don't really have enough mud to make them more dense than the surrounding salt water. So these type of river plumes tend to be hypopycnal, that is, they tend to float on the surface and then rain out the mud afterwards in a slow process that eventually builds up and might cause avalanches. There are some rivers in the world, especially after strong storms and events, that get so laden with particles that they really do sink. They are heavy when they enter. Those would be hyperpycnal river plumes. But just as a separate motivation, this was actually the problem that got me interested in this. I have a colleague, Andy Bush, and his brother, John Bush, co-authored a paper with Clark looking at a climate problem. This is looking back now here about, I think it's 12,000 years. It's near the end of the last ice age. And at the end of the last ice age, as the glaciers were retreating, there is a large ice dam that was set up here, effectively over where Hudson's Bay is presently, but also flooding what's the better part of northern Ontario. So you had this lake here, which is called Lake Agassiz. Of course, it doesn't exist anymore. And the lake would have loved to punch through here and enter the Atlantic Ocean, but there was a big ice dam set up by the Laurentide Ice Sheet. However, there was a pathway through which this fresh water could make it to the Atlantic Ocean, and that was by running through this river, which ultimately enters the Gulf of St. Lawrence and goes to the Gulf of St. Lawrence and then shoots out into the Atlantic. And records, observations seem to imply that this was going on for 100 years. So for 100 years, fresh water was pouring into the Atlantic, and yet there was really no cooling signature from that. And why would you expect that? Well, because if you waited after a few hundred years, this ice dam did break. The water up here is about 500 meters above sea level. So when this ice dam broke, this water rushed out through here, and the whole lake emptied in a month, and that caused another mini ice age. And that's because it capped the Atlantic Ocean with fresh water, turning off what's known as the thermohaline circulation. So you didn't get that efficient exchange of heat between the atmosphere and ocean anymore. So it caused a mini ice age. So when this rushed in there, it caused an ice age. But meanwhile, all this water was rushing out all the time, no ice age. And the hypothesis in this paper is that, well, because it ran down this river, all the time it was picking up silt and sand and rocks and so on, so that when it dumped into the Atlantic Ocean, it was hyperpycnal. It was so laden with particles that it sank below the surface instead of capping fresh water on top of the surface. So that was the hypothesis, but even if it did sink, eventually the rocks are going to settle out. So why doesn't the fresh water just go right back to the surface? And so the hypothesis that we're proposing is because the system stratified. So these are the experiments. there's been quite a few studies in similar configurations to this, where you have tanks of water, you do a lock release experiment where you pull out a lock, pull out a gate that separates, say, fresh water and particles mixed together, and it runs down a slope. That's been done where it's just uniform density fluid. But in this case, we're going to have linearly stratified fluid, so it's very salty water here, and it linearly becomes less and less salty towards the surface. But the surface water is still salty, so that if we didn't have particles here, this would be fresh, that would be salt, and you'd want to have a surface propagating current as a result. The only reason this is going to fall and slump downslope is because of the density introduced by some concentration of particles. So Kate was a star. If you don't know the GFD Summer School, these students have 10 weeks with which to attend lectures, choose a project, run a whole bunch of experiments in her case, do the analysis, and write up and give a presentation of results all in 10 weeks total. Really, it's only about 7 weeks. She did 108 laboratory experiments in the course of 5 weeks, and the rest of the time was just learning and developing the analysis tools and pulling together the paper. So she was a rock star. You can see, you'll see one reason why she was able to do so many experiments, because just for the sake of time and trying to cover as much parameter space as we could, we did a lot of repeat experiments. So that, for example, this experiment might just have fresh water dyed yellow, and this is, say, stratified salt water. So the fresh water goes up top. When the experiment's done, it really hasn't changed the situation much at all. So rather than emptying the tank and refilling it from scratch, we just put the gate in here, mop up whatever fluid's in the lock, add some more fresh water, and put in some particles or something, and then run another experiment. So she was able, in many cases, she ran about 5 experiments in 1 tank of water. And we did some experiments in reverse to confirm that it didn't matter the direction. Okay, so I'm going to show you 9 movies that try to explore parameter space and give you an idea of how changing some parameters changes what you see. And I'm going to start with the case that is, I'd say, best studied. These 3 experiments all have uniform density ambience. So this is just salt water with a fixed salinity such that the density of the salt water is 1.067. This top experiment is an experiment where I have particles and fresh water, and the sum of the particles and fresh water is such that the density is set to be slightly less than the density of the ambient, so this will form a hypopycnal river plume. So this is the Mississippi. There's our muddy water being carried out by the fresh water on top of our salty ocean. That looks pretty simple, but of course, eventually, though the particles are small, eventually they are heavier than water, and they do rain out. So this is the process that Eckhart talked about yesterday, of how even though the Mississippi may not run downslope, it eventually does deposit its sediments on the bottom of the slope, where they build up and build up and build up, and then some process, maybe an earthquake or whatever, causes an avalanche.
It's interesting how you see a secondary gravity current forming along the bottom, right?
You do indeed. You do indeed. But you're going to see more of that.
And how much mixing of your background stratification is this causing?
Well, so this, of course, is uniform density in the background. And you'll see as soon as we... this is just trying to... Because this is something you're familiar with. Well, if anyone's looked at this type of thing, this is what's typically studied, is uniform density ambient, and it just rains down. I'll show you that as soon as you have stratification, the process changes. Okay, so now the only thing that's changed here is we put in more particles, so that way... this is now hyperpycnal. It is more dense than the ambient, and it runs along the bottom. Okay, so this is a classic turbidity current running along the bottom. Of course, as it's running along the bottom, particles are always sedimenting out, and as the particles sediment out, then this, which started off as fresh water interstitial fluid, although it's mixed a little bit, it does find itself lighter than its surroundings, so it buoyantly rises. And in this case, I've introduced this jargon, metapycnal, because it does a bit of both. This is actually starts off so that it's supposed to be slightly heavier, but you can see Kate stirring vigorously all the heck there, which is always a problem with these lab experiments. Some particles do rain out, so what initially you see dominating is the fresh water that doesn't have all those particles in it. In fact, you can see the particles are constantly raining out here. So unlike this first case where it really just charged along, this thing is losing particles so quickly that eventually it piles up to form a turbidity current that runs along the bottom. So you get two for the price of one in this experiment. And to my mind, this experiment has been studied a bit, and that's been studied a bit, but this whole idea of a transition from one to the other, I don't think has been commented upon too much in the literature. But
I think people have looked at kind of the opposite thing, where you initially form the hyperpicon current along the bottom, and then as the particles rain out, the ambient fluid, or the interstitial fluid, is positive, becomes positively buoyant and lifts up.
Yeah, so that's this case. Yeah.
But we don't really, but we don't see the front lift up, right?
I think and the last one right now is what you're talking about. Is it just in a very intersection, it just rose up?
Yeah, that's right. Now the bottom current has.
Yeah, so at some point, basically, it's because all the particles run out.
Yeah.
And then there's nothing but buoyantly rising. This sort of has buoyantly rising fluid everywhere along its tail. This one, because it takes so long to develop to begin with, it kind of goes down, but then it runs out of steam. Anyways, just for the sake of time, this isn't even what I want to talk about, because all this is uniform ambient. Let me now show you experiments where we have stratification. So now this is very salty water becoming gradually less salty as you go to the surface. And the way that that stratification is characterized is by something called a buoyancy frequency, which I think everyone here is familiar with. So it's just a measure of the strength of the stratification, and that's relatively strong stratification. I'm going to start off with a control where I have a gate in here, and there are no particles in here. This is just salt water. So I've added, or Kate has added, salt to the lock. Such that its density is 1.08. And though it doesn't say it here, the density of the salt water in the ambient up here is about 1.02. So this is still heavier than the ambient. It will want to fall. Okay. So release it. So this is, I wouldn't call it, it's not a turbidity current, but this is a classic gravity current going down a slope, but it's in ambient stratification. And that is the effect of ambient stratification. There is a point where through entrainment, as it goes down the slope, it is always diluting itself and eventually reaches a level of neutral buoyancy where its density is the same as that as the ambient. This thing started off at 1.08, but the actual position of 1.08, I believe, is actually might even be down here. So this is not the density level where it's 1.08, it's actually much less, it's more like 1.04, 1.03 or something. Okay, so now what happens if you do almost an identical experiment, trying to get the parameters as close as possible? This is no longer salt water, this is fresh water, but we've added particles, relatively small. These are just glass beads. We've added particles with a density so that it's 1.1 grams per centimeter, just a bit more than that. Again, you stir like crazy, you release it, it goes down. And the thing you see here is qualitatively, it's almost the same in that it goes down and it separates, but of course it's doing so at a much higher level. And that's because there's two things going on here. You not only get the dilution of the fluid as it goes down slope, but you have particles raining out. And both those things make it less dense. So it reaches its neutral buoyancy level at a higher, let's say a shallower distance from the surface. Let's just crank up the number of particles so that this is well heavier than the dense fluid at the bottom. But again, because of particles raining out, because of entrainment of ambient fluid, eventually it stops and separates in the boundary. And you see it's a bit different than the salty case because it doesn't just go out along a line. In fact, it goes out at a whole bunch of different levels as a series of fingers, which are more or less established by sort of distances between billows. in the rear of the head. And you also see that as it goes down, there's also fluid going back up, and that's because this motion going down presumably is exciting internal waves, which is basically waves that move inside a fluid, and they exist because of buoyancy, because the density is varying with height in the ambient. Okay. So those are just three experiments where I'm fooling around with changing the density of our number of particles. Here I'm going to keep the particle concentration roughly the same, well, a bit different, but I'm going to keep the density of the lock the same, but I'm going to change the size of the particles to look at the effect of the settling rate. In this case, because these particles get big, we also did this in a much longer lock, twice the length of the last time. So these are relatively small particles. It would be the same as the previous set of experiments I showed you, where it's going down, separates as a nose, although there are some interesting dynamics that occur later on as it's beginning to try to sediment, but also these internal wave actions are causing shearing motions that sort of retard it. But then it kind of goes back here, and then you get some instability. It's just damn complicated. Wouldn't this be fun to simulate, Eckhart?
Yeah.
Okay, so now you have larger sized particles. It's still the same density difference, but because these are larger sized, they're able to rain out at a faster rate. And you see it's, you can actually watch them rain out in this case. More or less what you're left with here is just fresh water without any particles, but you are getting a buildup of particles down at the bottom. And this last case are the biggest particles we worked with. So here, basically, particles are just gone. And then everything else is almost like a passive ambient responding to these internal wave stations. Okay. So that's just a 10% of the experiments that Kate did. But I chose these because I think they did the best job of delineating what you see as you change these important parameters in all those experiments. Let me just go through a little bit of analysis. She actually did a lot of analysis. I'm just going to do the simple things. First question is, how fast does it go down the slope, and where does it separate from the slope if it's stratified? So these are just plots from three different experiments. What you do is you take movies and you grab a slice through the movie along a line that's parallel to the slope just above the bottom. And then you just look at that line, watch how it evolves in time, and that lets you track the front so you can get the along slope position as a function of time. So this is an experiment with a relatively small density of lock fluid, higher density and higher density still. So you can see, say, in the highest density case, it goes well down slope as time advances at pretty fast speed, and then you see it sort of has this maximum and then this oscillation, presumably as an interaction with internal waves. So we're just going to focus on, for now, what is the value of that slope, what sets the speed.
Can I ask about the period? Mm-hmm. Shouldn't that be something of the order of these 3 seconds?
That it should be of the order of 2 pi over 3. So the buoyancy frequency is 3, which is in radians per second. So the period should be on the order of 2 pi over that, which is 2, but of course it's a triangular geometry, and I don't even want to go into that, but if you put internal waves in a triangular geometry, they do not at all slosh like waves in my coffee cup. They actually form weird geometric attractors, and they're very strange patterns.
There must also be a sloshing mode set up from the initial down release because the pressure's out of equilibrium, so that may actually be a surface wave that you'll see.
As if the surface itself was deflecting, and you're seeing that down there.
Yeah, we've seen that with trying to track lobe and cleft instabilities. You actually see that the front is moving back and forth, and the period is set from the initial conditions, and there's a slight sloshing on the surface. You always get these experiments.
I don't think that's the case, and I'm saying that in part because in some experiments, again, she is stirring like crazy. She pulls it out, and you can see the front kind of going like this, and that's definitely surface wave. But in some experiments, and I haven't shown you that, she put in potassium permanganate crystals to make vertical dye lines. And you can see then the internal structure of the wave. And you can see that even if the current is coming down here, the line out here is already sort of deforming. So it really looks like it's an internal motion, and you can see that whole motion responding to this current coming down, as opposed to, say, what is obviously a faster frequency motion you get from that initial release. Okay, so there isn't much theory specifically on this problem, but I'm just going to go back to what is well established in the way of theory, and that's the theory for a gravity current moving along the bottom of a flat bottom rectangular tank. And there's a theory says if it's just, say, salt water going into fresh water, then the speed is related to the density difference between the current and the ambient through this reduced gravity G prime, and the height of the current, which is typically half the height of the lock from which it was released. So I measure things in terms of the height of the lock from which it's released. And that the relationship between the speed and this non-dimensional quantity with units of speed is related by this Froude number, and if it's energy conserving field assumptions, you get a half. If it's actually the same density, if the nose has the same density as the isopycnel in front of it, so it's almost like an intrusion, but the ambient is stratified, then it no longer, you don't care about the density difference between the current and the ambient, you care about the stratification. So the relationship between speed and the stratification over the depth of the current goes as a Froude number with a 1/4 power. So to try to bring these two things together, because we have both, we have a density jump between the lock and the ambient, and we also have stratification, we're going to form a plot here of U over this quantity, which we expect will be some function of a quantity, I'm going to call it beta, which is just this speed that you would get based on stratification and this speed that you get based on density jumps. With the idea being, if this parameter is small, so if stratification is zero, almost zero, negligible, then you should just get your 1/2 result. So you should just get 1/2. Whereas if stratification is dominating, so this beta quantity is large, then U should be going as NH, which means this F of beta should be something like a 1/4 beta. So here's a plot of the data where we could get some, let's say, decent measurements of speeds. and it does hover around 0.5 with a whole bunch of errors. But of course, this is going down slope. It's not flat bottom. So you do expect a slight increase in speed, but the experiments that were done by Britter and Linden show that even if it's going down slope, it doesn't accelerate. It's still, through entrainment and puffing up its head height, it still gets to a new equilibrium where it goes down at a constant speed, but slightly faster. So we're seeing values around 0.5, slightly higher. I have these points here, and I have looked at the experiments. I have no idea why they're down there. So I still don't fully understand the data. This dashed line here is just me trying to draw 1/4 beta. So it's just trying to show that at least if this parameter goes all the way up to 1, you're still not in a regime where stratification is dominating. And I think for most of the applications in the ocean of, say, river plumes coming out and so on, you're going to be dealing in a regime where this quantity is small. It's really the density difference between the incoming fluid and the ambient that's dominating. So the other thing that we try to measure here is this point of where it separates. And this is the nastiest slide I got in terms of maths, but I thought I'd just give it to you all at once and get it over with, okay? And I could have just not put any of it all, but I just didn't want to sweep it under the rug. The plan is you come with a formula for how the volume of this thing, this is really volume per unit width, so it's area, how does that change as a function of time as a result of entrainment, okay? So we're assuming that if it goes down at a speed u, then it's always entraining fluid through all this billow action at a rate that's proportional to u with the proportionality constant alpha, which is, you know, typically you can take that to be about 0.1. So you make that assumption, so that gives you a rate of how much is bulking up, how the volume is increasing, and hence you can work out how its density is decreasing as it goes down because it's bulking up, because it's entraining fluid. That says nothing about particles. So then you put in particles. You say that the particles are going to rain out at the Stokes settling velocity over its depth h. But of course, h is increasing because the volume is bulking up. So you get another formula for how the concentration of particles change as a function of the volume changing, which ultimately is a function of time. And then finally, you match what is the density of this current going down as a function of time, and you compare that to the density of the ambient where it happens to be sitting, where L, that position, is a function of time. You solve for time, you recast that in terms of what's the depth of that time, just since you know U is L is UT, and you know the slope, you got the depth. So that's the gross prediction for the depth at which this thing should separate from the bottom. It does not to account for inertia, that it actually should overshoot before separating. It says that's the point where the density is the same as the ambient within all these approximations. Okay, and it should at least be order of magnitude correct. It's got, again, this entrainment parameter. It's got this beta parameter, which is measure the speed of stratification due to speed to density differences. And it's got this new interesting parameter, which is called gamma, which is a ratio of the Stokes settling velocity, the tendency to sediment, divided by the entrainment velocity, this quantity, the tendency for the current to bulk itself up due to mixing. So there's sort of competing effects. If you didn't have particles, gamma is zero, and you'd have a straightforward formula for that gamma mixing slightly more complicated. So this is the measurements on this axis of the separation distance compared to the depth of the lock that we started with, just to give you an idea of scale. And this is the theory, that formula I just presented on the previous slide. And that dashed line is the one-to-one line. So it doesn't do bad, but again, there's a few points over here, and I've looked at them. Those experiments don't seem dramatically different in parameter space than any of these other experiments, so I don't know what's going on. Okay. Let me flash ahead to a different subject, because I don't want to be going super over time here.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Did your student do any different experiments with this specific particle size for which you had these large excursions, or were all the particle sizes treated in the same experiments, or?
So in this, it's all the symbols here.
Yeah, it's only the 29 micrometer experiments that are far off.
Yeah, in part, most of our experiments were with these two sets of particles. These large particles, they just settle out so quickly that the initial condition you have of stirring the lock, pulling out the gate, it's already separating by the time, you know, it basically leaves the gate.
So they fall quite close.
Yeah.
To
line. I know what you're saying, but you know, I could easily have seen there being another experiment with this 19, and it's flying over there. In fact, there were some experiments I saw where there were some blue points over there. But those are really messy experiments because she'd done this repeating set of experiments. So some of them had already went through a whole bunch of previous experiments with particles already laid down, and then it did crazy stuff. And so I decided, in those circumstances, well, maybe that's just crazy stuff. I'm going to throw away that point. But I couldn't justify throwing away these. So, and maybe that's crazy stuff, too, and I just couldn't see it. But like I said, this is still work in progress.
Can I also ask one last question about your recurrence? What are typical values for your gamma parameter, the settling velocity and the entrainment expansion?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wish I had off the top of my head. But it's always less than one. My intuition is it's around 0.1.
Right.
But that is something I could work out. I just haven't done very well. Okay, so completely different topic now. That was all looking at particles being transported and how do they settle. This is now an issue of particles are already on the ground. How are they resuspended as a result of an external phenomena, which is an internal wave coming in and crashing on a shore? So you may not be too familiar with internal waves, and I'm going to try to guide you into that, but movies are worth a thousand words, so just bear with me if you don't follow what I say right now. This is a satellite picture of the surface of the ocean around here, just off northwestern Australia. What you're seeing is the sun glint, where there are areas where the ocean surface is very rough. You end up getting a lot more scatter of sunlight, so you see bright. Where the ocean is very glassy and flat, the light just reflects at an angle, and so if you're way up here, you won't see a thing. It will look darker. So you're seeing patches of roughness and smoothness, and those patches of roughness and smoothness are the result of waves that are underneath the surface. So what happens, you have the surface of the ocean, underneath you have the thermocline, which is basically a jump between warm and colder waters, and that interface between warm and cold can undulate up and down just like surface waves on the ocean. Except they do so under buoyancy. It's not water air, it's cold water, warm water, so they do so slowly. Okay? But as those waves go up and down, they actually stretch apart and compress together the surface, creating these regions of either roughness or glassiness. So this is why, even though these waves are underneath the surface, you can see them. And I chose this particular location because that dot there, which is roughly where this picture is, and I don't think, I do get a scale, it's about 100 kilometers. I think it is about there that there's an offshore oil platform, which you can see is interacting quite strongly with these waves. This is one of the reasons why the oil industry takes some interest in internal waves, because gosh knows climate people really don't care at all. And the reason, one reason, there's actually a whole list of reasons I've heard of why the oil industry cares, but this is one reason I'm going to use to motivate. In Australia in particular, unlike the Blue Horizon Gulf of Mexico, in Australia, they don't pump the oil to the surface and carry it away. As soon as the oil comes out the ground, it gets put into a pipeline that runs along the ground towards the shore, about 400 kilometers. Where it's being pumped out of the ground, it's below the thermocline. At some point, it crosses the thermocline, and eventually it's on the coast. So there's a point where these waves, internal waves, are sloshing back and forth across these pipes, stirring up sediments, and degrading the integrity that holds the pipeline up. And that's a big concern for the oil industry. So that's one motivation. This is a more eco-friendly motivation. This is the Dongsha Atoll, which is in the South China Sea. It is constantly being whacked by internal waves that are launched by tides way out to the Luzon Strait. For whatever reason, it's probably nonlinear feedback, there's a bit of a hill here which causes these waves to shoal. They stir up sediments, and fish and corals and everything loves all that stuff, so they grow more and they create more of an obstacle. So what you have here is this atoll, which is just very rich in marine life. And the question is, how do the waves behave as they, first of all, impact head-on, shoaling? That's what I'm going to talk about today. We've also done some problems where it goes over the shoulder and back out, which is more of a tunneling problem. But let me just talk about the shoaling problem. So here is an experiment where we're going to launch an internal solitary wave and have it crash on a slope. So this is salt water of uniform density here. Above the green line, which is just green dye, we have fresh water. We put a gate in the tank. It doesn't go all the way to the bottom. And what we do is we just slowly add some more fresh water, which deepens that surface level. So we got fresh water, salt water, same fresh water, same salt water. As you add that fresh water, see this salt water just comes under the bottom. And then when we pull this gate out, it's like a gravity current experiment, but it's not fluid of one density going to fluid of another density. This is going into the exact same density fluid. Instead of launching a gravity current, it launches an internal solitary wave. So think of the green line as the thermocline of the ocean. Some tide or something has just launched this wave. And now you get this hump-shaped wave, which is quite large amplitude. And then it shoals on the ocean and does surprisingly complicated things. Okay, so this is the behavior that we're trying to understand. And ultimately, for the purpose of the talk, we're trying to get to grips with how this turbulent processes end up resuspending particles. So the way that this wave can be characterized and the method through which it breaks can be characterized is an analogy taken from surface waves. We're going to define an error-bar number, which for historical reasons is defined as a topographic slope, that S, divided by the square root of the wave slope. I don't know why the square root's in there, but that's how it's done. So basically, if you think of it, if you have, here's the amplitude of the wave, here's the horizontal extent of the wave, order of magnitude, it's the square root of the amplitude over the length. Okay. And the wave breaks differently depending on the value of this error-barren number. So just think, as this error-barren number is going down, getting smaller, it means my slope's going from steep to shallow. So if it's really steep, it just reflects. But you're going to see that as you make it shallower, you get this weird recirculation region, which is something you don't see for surface waves. If you make it shallower still, you get a mix of this recirculation region and this bit above that captures, that goes over and plunges. And then finally, you get what looks like a breaking wave on the surface of the ocean, where here's your beach, here's the water running down the slope, and here's this going over, except the surface is up here. All this is taking place at the interface underneath the surface. So I want to show you each of those types of breaking. In some of these experiments, we were beginning to toy around with particles. So we actually put some clay on the slope, and we realized it's very difficult to put clay in the slope and just have it stay there. So this is just clay that decided to intrude. But it does give you a visualization of what's happening in the interior. Okay, so that's just a straight reflection. Wave comes in, it does the same thing as if it was a vertical wall. This, in the jargon, again, it's an attempt to make be an analogy to what happens with surface waves. This would be called a surging breaker. And it's kind of difficult to see, but at least as this goes down, what I hope you see is the nose kind of becomes gravitationally unstable there. But in the end, nothing exciting happens. It bends over a bit, but then it just goes back up, almost like it's reflecting. But in this case, you make the slope just a little bit shallower. Now you can get that overturning area to form a recirculating vortex that goes opposite to the direction of the propagating wave. So again, kind of tricky to see, but I hope you get it. So it goes down, and see that little region in there? It actually goes up and goes like that. It doesn't go like that. So that's it collapsing. Now, all of these are steep slopes. This is now beginning to get closer to, this is still pretty far from oceanic slopes, but this is the closest case. So here's all the wave coming in. This is in a longer tank. And so here, you see this recirculating region, and you also see a bit of that fluid plunging over. And this last case is just strictly plunging, which is the closest case to looking like a wave breaking ashore. So again, this is the flat surface. The only thing that happens on the surface is it moves horizontally back and forth. You don't really see vertical deflections. As this comes in, this is, you can just imagine this is the water running down the beach while you've got this great wave. And if Jim could get scuba gear as well, you'd be surfing that, I'm sure. It'd be just a blast. This, that would be a great new sport, eh? Scuba surfing, just. It'd be pretty slow-mo, though. Okay. Okay, it's obviously getting late. All right. Okay, so just one little simple bit of analysis is you want to work out where does this breaking occur? This thing comes in, what's the maximum depth over which it breaks, or how far from this point up here does it break? And you can do a simple analysis just saying, well, this looks roughly like a triangle. You match the area of that triangle to the area of the incoming wave based on its amplitude and length, and you get a decent prediction. So this is the measured depth at which this of this point here, the maximum depth at which the fluid descended to breaking, and this is the prediction for that maximum depth. It's pretty close to a one-on-one line, especially for the very small slopes, which are the plunging breakers for which this theory works best. Okay. So that's good because now you can have a prediction. If you know something about the incoming wave, the offshore oil industry knows that that's the point in the ocean where the wave is going to break the deepest. And it's an important point because if you look closely at this experiment, you can see this isn't just sand, but I actually put some particles on here. And that wave is causing an avalanche. And then it's causing particle resuspension. So this point of maximum deepening and the fetch leading towards it is crucial to know where that is and what's going on. And incidentally, the particles there are poppy seeds because I could not get sand to resuspend for my life. It's just the fineness of the sand, the cohesion of the sand, but poppy seeds are wonderful. And they're nice and black, but they smell after a few days. That's the bad part. Okay. In these experiments, I didn't explain, but we have here an ADCP, so we're able to measure the speeds of the flow and get plots like this of as the wave, this is time going here, as the wave comes in, we have an X component, a Y component, which is across the span, and a Z component, which is vertical. And you can see that it goes negative X and negative Z in tandem, and in fact, that gives you exactly the downslope speed. And after that, you get lots of turbulence. But from things like that, we can measure the speeds of the flow at the point of breaking and compare that. We're trying to come up with diagnostics so you can predict things like speeds knowing the incoming solitary wave characteristics. And it seemed that the speed was of that flow at the bottom was best predicted in terms of the incoming shallow water speed, the incoming solitary wave speed. Again, lots of scatter, but you do see that there's a bit of a relationship. And we cast this not just in terms of speed versus solitary wave speed, but of course I've non-dimensionalized it by quantity so that this axis becomes the Shields parameter, which is a typical parameter used to measure the ability of the flow to resuspend sediment. So effectively it's a measure of the stress to the weight per area of the particles that are trying to oppose the stress of lifting. Okay. And that seems, I guess that's typically what's done, but I just want to point out that there's a problem with applying the Shields parameter, because the Shields parameter was defined for uniform flow of, say, a river over a sediment-laden bed. This is not a uniform flow, it's a transient flow, and in fact, all the action is happening here in terms of resuspension at the stagnation point, which is where the flow is zero, and hence the Shields parameter is zero. So the Shields parameter, if you just did it point-wise, is not a good diagnostic. What I showed you for the Shields parameter was a characteristic measure of these flows upstream and downstream, and hence it gave you a characteristic measure of the kind of divergence you see here, and that's really the scalar quantity you need to predict this kind of resuspension. But that's still something that we're trying to work on, the right diagnostic. Okay, so I'm going to just spend just 10 more minutes, if that's all right, on just one last thing. That last problem got me interested in the whole idea of how do you move around particles if you don't have a uniform flow? What happens if you just have a turbulent flow that's statistically stationary? That's kind of difficult to make, but what we shot for was something close to this, which is basically a water jet blasting into a bed of sand. So this is the experiment where we just have a jet that comes out here. Everything here is just done with fresh water. So we blast out fresh water. There's a little nozzle here that makes it turbulent as soon as it leaves the nozzle. It goes down and hits a uniform depth bed of sand, which are just these tiny glass beads, again, ranging in size from, I think it's about 50 micrometers to 100 micrometers. But each experiment was more or less one grain size. And so the plan is, how do they resuspend? We had two different analysis tools. This is one of the problems with doing sediment experiments, because it's really difficult to measure deposition. But Stuart DL in Cambridge developed this fun little thing called a depositometer, which are a whole bunch of electrodes. This is just a skew view of the bottom of the tank. And the idea is if you have particles on top of these electrodes, then there's more resistivity from this electrode to, say, some negative anode way up here. Okay, so each electrode is measuring particle depth through resistivity of the particles lying above it. Another way, which is a lot easier, is just light attenuation. If you had shine light from the bottom, then if you coat the thing with particles, less light gets through, and you can do a calibration to relate light intensity to particles. So this is an experiment running in real time. That's the nozzle of the jet. It looks massive, but the actual opening is just 0.2 centimeters. And it's blasting down in this bed of sand here. I've got some of the particles, so this are 90 micrometer glass beads. I'm blasting away so that the fluid leaving here is coming out at about 40 centimeters per second. At one point, I accidentally took the thing out of the tank when it was running, and it shot water across the room. It's amazing how when you put this into water, into a tank of water, it just looks like this nice, happy little plume. But it really is rocking out of here, but through entrainment, its momentum is reducing all the time, so that by the time it reaches the bed of the sand, it's predicted to have a speed of 4 centimeters per second, which is still pretty fast. These are turbulent fluctuations constantly banging in to this sand bed, and any one fluctuation might not do much. It's not like it's really transporting fluid, but cumulatively, it's shifting a particle here, shifting a particle there, so over time, you get this development of a crater. But the process is very slow in terms of the descent rate of that crater compared to the speed of the jet. So in terms of characterizing this, again, we measured either through the electric probes or through light attenuation, we can measure the rate at which this crater descends as a function of time. And interestingly, we found that the descent rate, the center of the crater always went down at nearly a constant speed, at least until it bottomed out. And the radius of the crater was almost constant during that process. That's something we didn't expect, but that's what we saw in almost all the experiments. So from that, we can go on to measure what is that speed of descent, which here is normalized by the Stokes settling velocity. Actually, it's not the Stokes settling velocity, it's the measured settling velocity of these particles. And again, measuring that against the Shields number, which is based on the speed of the jet, the mean speed of the jet at the bed, divided by for G prime D. So we get plots like this, which we can try to extrapolate backwards and say something about where the critical Shields number is for the beginning of suspension. And then once it exceeds that critical Shields parameter, then you can actually measure a speed of descent, which gets faster and faster as that Shields parameter gets larger. We did this again with different size particles and did it with white poppy seeds, which is way skewed over there. I wasn't particularly happy with this because it's almost a scatter, and to try to fit a line to this isn't that great.
How do you find the speed of the jet at the bed?
That's done theoretically. So it's just.
So if there was no bed with the entrainment.
Exactly. It's just using Morton-Taylor-Turmer extrapolation. Yeah. So I wasn't happy with the Shields parameter. So one thing that we tried alternately was to measure things in terms of a Rouse parameter. So the Rouse parameter is explicitly taking into account the Stokes settling velocity, or with the settling velocity of this particle compared to the speed of the jet. So how fast it wants to go down to how fast inertia is trying to transport it away. If it's small enough, you can relate the Shields parameter to the Rouse parameter through the particle Reynolds number. But the point is the Shields parameter says nothing about the settling velocity. It just says here's the buoyancy of the particle compared to the stress. This says something about the buoyancy of the particle, the viscosity, something about the settling rate. And for what it's worth, it just seems slightly better in terms of how we can measure the speeds relative to the settling velocity versus the Rouse parameter, come up with the critical number, and come up with slopes to these lines, which may not be great, but at least it was better in terms of measuring what the critical Rouse parameter was. And then finally, this is just technical stuff, but once you know the speed of descent, we found that the speed of descent was almost constant during the whole crater formation process, and the radius was constant, which means the sediment volume flux is constant. As long as you surpass the critical threshold so that you form a crater, then you have a constant sediment volume flux. So by analogy to having flow, uniform flow of a riverbed picking up sediment, we form a non-dimensional volume flux and come up with this non-dimensional volume flux, which we can characterize in terms of these external parameters, the difference between the Rouse parameter and the critical Rouse parameter, which is just when the crater begins to form. So that's just some measurements we got. Okay, so to try and pull the disparate sections of the talk together, the thing that really we're trying to get at here is what happens in terms of particle transport and sedimentation when you have a stagnation point in the flow. Okay, so whether it's a stagnation point as a result of boundary layer separation at the maximum deepening, whether it's a stagnation point in terms of a separation point of the flow from the boundary here, or even a statistical stagnation point. If you look at the mean flow of the jet, the center point of the jet has zero mean radial velocity. But that's, of course, where the crater deepens most. But that's really because there's always fluctuations going back and forth, back and forth. But in the mean, it's zero, and nonetheless, you see deepening. So the thing that's trying to connect it together, this is really just doing our best to make it seem like a coherent talk. The thing that's trying to keep together is how do you characterize sediment transport when you have a stagnation point, and still working on the problem. I appreciate your feedback. Thanks.
Even where you've got a stagnation point, so there's a maximum of pressure, but it's a porous bed, so that will induce some flow. So even just from that might then entrain particles away from the point.
Mm-hmm.
The pressure gradient.
That's true. Yeah, so
it's also have shear away from the stagnation.
Yeah.
I mean, because the reality is, and that's a good point, because it's not a rigid wall, there is going to it. But the reality is, of course, you really have fluctuations which are on the order of the mean speeds. So the flow, you know, is never zero at the midpoint. It's always going this way and that way and this way and that way.
Even with the laminar flow, this pressure gradient might, even if you have a laminar flow, so it's completely steady, the pressure gradients would probably move the particles
And that's a very good point, you're right.
And the pressure gradients responsible for the fluctuations of the flow?
You could have a steady flow, but you still have a maximum of pressure gradients.
But in the real situation, I think these pressure gradients are responsible for pushing the flow around the center and avoiding the lamina structure of the flow, no?
Yeah, in terms of what I've seen, because it's really hard to see from these movies, but when you eyeball it, you sort of see like individual poofs of particles, they go, and then nothing happens for a few seconds, another poof of particles goes there. And so it's sort of transient bed load transport, as opposed to sort of a laminar thing that would be sort of a steady going out. So it really is transient, so I think it is more the basic turbulent fluctuations that are driving what we're seeing here.
Is there a reason why you didn't put a profiling ADV in your vertical jet, just to actually see what the turbulence intensity is?
Well, the short answer is there I was in Cambridge, and there I was in Western Australia. Greg Iady had the ADCPs in his lab, but Stuart didn't.
What's the Reynolds number of your jet based on the exit diameter and the exit velocity?
The Reynolds numbers are pretty high, around 5,000 to 10,000 based on the quantities at the source. So the speeds were typically in the order of half a meter per second. Coming out of nozzles about 0.2 centimeters. So they're pretty high. And I did do a few experiments, and to get an idea of what the flow was like, in a few experiments I did put dye in the jet, and you could really just see, it looks so calm when you watch that movie, it just doesn't look like anything's happening. You put dye in there, and it's just immediately, there's just purple, and stuff's just, it's moving like crazy, and the bed is just barely responding to it. But nonetheless, it does respond in a nice, consistent way in terms of constant deepening rate, which is nice.
In your internal wave experiments, is there any way that you can quantify how much of the particles are eroded due to the reflection of the internal waves as they arrive at their scope, as opposed to that recirculation?
It's a really good question. It's a measuring sediment deposits. It's really difficult, and our focus wasn't on getting to that detail. I will say that avalanche that I showed you, that typically did not occur. That was the most dramatic experiment because that slope was right near the critical slope of wanting to avalanche. But we did experiments where it's more realistic of slopes, say about 0.08, I think was the lowest slope we had. And you never saw avalanching, but you did see lots of stirring of particles and more bed load transport going on. But again, we didn't characterize quantities of what it is. Just we weren't set up to be able to do that. It'd be good to do things.
Maybe to come back to the clay, I looked up a bit some papers I knew from before. About collapsing gels. So, and some of these experiments have also been performed with laminite, which is, I think, a form of clay.
Okay.
And in these experiments, people will start with a very weak gel that then collapses. So the question would be whether you have a feeling for whether your clay suspensions with which you start might contain a very weak fractal gel of clay platelets already, or whether this is just too dilute to have such a structure.
My feeling is it's too dilute.
It's too dilute. I couldn't figure out what you need in terms of volume fraction to get these gels.
Part is because Caillou did these experiments, he explored quite a range of concentrations of clay as well as salinities, from almost no clay whatsoever to increasing it. And you didn't see any sudden changes in behavior as if suddenly you got to, say a hindering stage or something like that. Everything seemed relatively pretty smooth.
Because for these clay gels, they behave like a yield stress fluid, where somehow you have to overcome a certain threshold, and then you get kind of a collapse of the gel. Looks a bit like you see, but
like I think.
Another regime.
I mean, a typical concentration you have would be at say 20 parts per thousand.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, like it's 2%, although that's by weight. But even if you factor in the weight of clay, it's more like maybe, you know, be less than 2%, be 1% concentration. So I just don't think we're anywhere near that kind of structure.
Just another point about the clays as well. If you keep on agitating them in fresh water, they will flock. Shiver, yeah, it's shown. There's nothing magic about about salt rock, particularly for flocking the clays. You just have to agitate them for long enough to make them actually flock. So the flocking results are generally more fresh and cool water. And all of the clay in the Mississippi affluent is flocked.
Even before it enters, yeah, okay. It's funny because so that paper, the stuff on clay, we have submitted and got back from a reviewer, and his criticism was two reviewers liked it. It's always a third reviewer criticized the work, saying, "Well, that all looks fine, but I've done these experiments and I see fronts forming in freshwater," whereas we didn't. But he said he did them in test tubes, whereas we did ours in a tank. And so there's also the other issue of just boundaries.
Sure.
You have a test tube, if it's sloping, that completely changes how things settle. There's also a question of, you're saying that, well, maybe you're seeing fronts because you're not stirring it enough. Maybe you need to really go in there with an industrial hand mixer and stir it. And then you wouldn't see a front form in the salt. So on the one hand, you're saying, well, you should see fronts. On the other hand, you said you shouldn't see fronts. I wasn't even sure what to make of it in the end. But all I know is that when we did the experiments, we often repeated them. So, for example, the freshwater ones, Kai would record that experiment for a day, and basically gradually it would get lighter and lighter and lighter. Once it was done, she'd stir the whole thing up, re-record, and it would still take a day. So that would, even though it's kind of compactifying at the end, stir it up and it didn't change anything. Whereas with the saltwater ones, we'd stir it all up again and same front would form, descend at the same rate. So we didn't see an effect of that compactification repeatability change what we saw in this experiment.
Was it distilled water or tap water?
That's a good question. I believe it's just tap water. Although Edmonton's got excellent water. But yes, it was. It probably did have a few impurities in there.
All right, good. If there are no more questions, then thanks for having me.